The United States and Britain launched new strikes on Yemen's Houthis.
Airstrikes by warplanes, by surface ships, by submarine, targeting 8 Houthi locations across Yemen.
A new Hindu temple in India on a site bitterly contested by Hindus and Muslims.
Hindus believe the site in the city of Ayodhya, in the northern state of Uttar Pradesh, to be the birthplace of the god Lord Ram.
And the world's first routine vaccination program against malaria is launched in Cameroon.
Malaria kills nearly 500,000 children under the age of 5 in Africa every year.
Today is Tuesday, January 23rd, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Scott Walterman. The United States and Britain launched new strikes on Yemen's Houthis on Monday, saying their second round of joint military action against the Iran-backed rebels was in response to continued attacks on shipping. Joining us now from the Pentagon is VOA's national security correspondent Jeff Selden. Tell us about tonight's attacks.
Well, the U.S., along with Britain and with the support of some familiar allies, Australia, Bahrain, Canada, and the Netherlands, for the second time in the last 10 days, these countries got together and they launched a series of strikes, airstrikes by warplanes, by surface ships, by submarine, targeting 8 Houthi locations across Yemen. And defense officials from the U.S. tell us that at these locations, there were multiple targets that were hit. Initial estimate is that some 25 to 30 precision munitions were used at minimum in this operation. And the targets that they looked at and that they think they hit include air defense systems, some radars, missile launchers, and missile systems. But also critically, they say they hit a deeply buried weapon storage facility. And they said this storage facility was harboring and hiding some more advanced capabilities that the Houthis had, advanced in terms of missiles, advanced in terms of drones. And they think they were able to hit that. And they think that for the most part, they were able to remove these assets, these capabilities from the Houthis' arsenal as a message that these countries were serious. The Houthis needed to stop the attacks. They didn't. And if the attacks continue, the U.S. and its allies are saying there will continue to be consequences.
In the past attacks, they hit targets that they thought were imminent threats. Were some of what they hit tonight in that category, or were they going like the buried weapons to deeper hits against their capabilities?
You're right. The last several strikes up until tonight were characterized by the U.S., and they were U.S.-only strikes as self-defense strikes. Though there were instances in which U.S. intelligence, by various means, saw that the Houthis had loaded a missile onto a launcher, was preparing to fire it at shipping, whether it was either in the Red Sea or the Gulf of Aden. And so they took what they called a self-defense strike to take out the missile before it could be launched. The strikes late Monday are different. The officials are characterizing this as a second warning that the Houthis need to stop entirely with these attacks, and that as long as the Houthis continue to try to attack international shipping, the U.S. and its allies will continue to target Houthi capabilities and take it out. And what officials have said from the podium at the Pentagon and other U.S. officials have said as well, it's really up to the Houthis how long they want to play this game. But the U.S., Britain, late Monday, trying to send a message that it is really in the Houthis' best interest to cease these attacks on international shipping and to stop impacting negatively so many countries that rely on shipments that go through these critical sea lanes in the Red Sea and the Gulf of Aden.
This comes at the same time as an increase in attacks against U.S. targets in the region, particularly one on Saturday that was different than that we had seen previous. Is that right?
U.S. officials have been concerned because all of this is happening in the shadow of the Israeli military offensive against the Hamas militant group in Gaza in response to the Hamas terrorist attacks of October 7th. And so since then, since mid-October, there's been about 150, more than 150 actually now, strikes and attacks on U.S. troops, U.S. forces, both in Iraq and Syria, mostly by Iranian-backed militias in both of those countries. There's also been these attacks since mid-November that the Houthis have launched, again, claiming that they're being launched in solidarity with the Palestinians, which are attacking ships and international vessels that are transiting the Red Sea and the Gulf of Aden. And while the drumbeat of these attacks, the pace of these attacks has mostly been steady, on Saturday, the Iranian-backed militias in Iraq launched what was a bigger barrage than they had to until this point. They targeted Al-Asad Air Base in Iraq. There were multiple rockets, multiple ballistic missiles that were launched. Most of them were taken out by U.S. defenses, but a couple of the missiles, a couple of the rockets did manage to hit the base, cause some minor damage, some structural damage to what the U.S. described as non-critical facilities. But there were also some U.S. injuries. There were at least two U.S. servicemen who suffered traumatic brain injuries. They were treated, cleared, they're back on duty. But the U.S. is taking note of this. They say this is a bigger attack, a more concerted attack than the Iranian militias have launched until this point. And again, U.S. officials are trying to signal that while they don't want to see conflict across the region escalate, while they're not seeking a war, both at the Pentagon and at the White House Monday, officials said that the Iranian-backed proxies and Iran itself should be aware that the U.S. will do what is necessary to protect its forces, protect its people, and protect its interests in the region.
VOA's national security correspondent Jeff Selden. Pressure is mounting against Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's government, both from inside Israel and from the international community. Monday, a group of relatives of Israeli hostages being held by Hamas in Gaza stormed a parliamentary committee session in Jerusalem, demanding that the lawmakers do more to try to free their loved ones.
Honestly, we don't know what to do anymore, and we feel a lot of desperation. And today in the Knesset, everything just blew up. We're tired. We have fathers here with their children in Gaza. We have children with their parents in Gaza. There's a one-year-old baby there. We've had enough, and we do not feel that our government is doing enough.
Over the weekend, thousands gathered in Tel Aviv, pressing for the government to do more to secure the release of those still being held. Relatives and supporters are also camping outside Netanyahu's home. In Brussels on Monday, European Union foreign ministers argued that the creation of a Palestinian state is the only credible way to achieve peace in the Middle East.
I think the more death, more destruction, more hardship for the Gaza people, for the Palestinian people, will not help to defeat Hamas or its ideology. It will not bring more security to Israel, on the contrary. And that's why we need to double our efforts with international partners to move from this deadly confrontation towards a solution.
European Union Foreign Policy Chief Josep Borrell, he and ministers meeting in Brussels expressed concern about Netanyahu's clear rejection of the idea for the creation of a Palestinian state. We're following these other stories from around the world. A major 7.1 magnitude earthquake struck along the mountainous China-Kyrgyzstan border early Tuesday, triggering warnings of potentially widespread damage. The quake hit just after 1800 GMT. It's about 2 a.m. local time. Mexico said Monday that U.S. military weapons had been detected entering the country. Mexico blames firearms trafficking from the United States for fueling drug cartel-related violence. Mexico has long pointed the finger at the U.S. and its lax gun laws for the flow of weapons to its cartels, which in turn are often funded by selling drugs to U.S. citizens. The U.S. Federal Aviation Administration has recommended that airlines expand their inspections of door plugs on Boeing 737 jets. They're saying that the door plug should also be inspected on Model 900ER jets, in addition to the MAX 9, which had the accident earlier this month. Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi led the consecration on Monday of a grand temple to the Hindu god Lord Ram on a site believed to be his birthplace. It was a historic event for the Hindu majority of the world's most populous nation. For decades, the site was bitterly contested by Hindus and minority Muslims, leading to riots in 1992 that killed 2,000 after a Hindu mob destroyed a 16th century mosque that had stood there. Here's Reuters correspondent Lauren Anthony.
The unveiling is a historic event for the Hindu majority of the world's most populous nation, but it also acts as a reminder of some of its worst sectarian strife. For decades, the temple site was bitterly contested by Hindus and minority Muslims, leading to nationwide riots in 1992 that killed 2,000 people. Most of those who died were Muslims, after a radical Hindu mob destroyed the Babri Mosque that had stood there since the 16th century. Muslims in Ayodhya spoke of the hurt around the temple's erection.
Everyone is carrying the grief of the mosque being demolished. Each and every one of us is saddened by it. If you take someone's home from them, they would be upset.
The pain of community has always been and will always be there. If someone's place of worship and their faith is threatened, there will be pain, automatically. But people are working according to the system and the law. But the pain of December 6th, when Babri Mosque was destroyed, will always be fresh for Muslims. Nothing can make us forget or reduce that.
In 2019, the Supreme Court handed the land over to Hindus and designated a separate plot for Muslims, where construction of a new mosque is yet to begin. Hindus say the site's holy nature predates 1528, when Muslim Mughals raised a temple to build the mosque. Many hail the new temple as a sign of Hinduism reawakening from centuries of foreign subjugation, including rule by dynasties like the Mughals. The inauguration comes ahead of general elections in May, where Modi is seeking a rare third term. The event delivers on a campaign promise his political party made more than three decades ago. India hails itself as a secular state, meaning it isn't supposed to be connected to any specific religion or belief system. Analysts say Modi's role in the ceremony shows supporters of his Hindu nationalist party that India is finally ready to end what they call the appeasement of minorities and move towards their goal of building a Hindu-first nation.
Reuters correspondent Lauren Anthony. VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Scott Walterman. A rally in the U.S. state of New Hampshire for Nikki Haley as the race for the 2024 Republican presidential nomination is down to two candidates.
Thank you so much. Thank you, guys.
Voters in New Hampshire go to the polls Tuesday. Now, while most of the people who ran for the nomination and dropped out have endorsed former President Donald Trump, Haley is still fighting for votes and resisting calls to drop out herself. Here's Associated Press correspondent Sagar Magani.
Happy pre-election day.
At a VFW hall in Franklin, Haley says the pressure is coming from the nation's political and media elite.
Say that I should drop out for the good of the country to support Donald Trump.
After the crowd booed and said no, Haley mentioned Trump's win in the Iowa caucuses and the low voter turnout.
America doesn't do coronations.
Her remarks came after another fellow South Carolina Republican decided to endorse Trump, Congresswoman Nancy Mace, days after Senator Tim Scott backed him. Sagar Magani at the White House.
VOA's Carolyn Presutti is also in New Hampshire and caught up with Donald Trump Jr. as he was making a campaign appearance for his father.
Hey, John.
How's it going?
How's your dad going
to
do?
I think he's going to do well. I think he's going to do well. We're just glad to be back up here.
What does it mean for DeSantis to have dropped out of the race?
Well, listen, I think, you know, the writing was on the wall. It makes sense. I think we have to unify, and we got to really take care of the big problem, which is what Democrat policy has done to this country in the last 3 years. You know, they could create all sorts of noise that they wanted about Trump when he was president, and then you had COVID. But look at the reality of the situation 3.5 years later. People are over it.
Equatorial Guinea fans have celebrated the biggest upset in Africa Cup of Nations history with a 4-0 rout of hosts Ivory Coast on Monday. In town for the games, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken.
It's great to be a small part of this here to honor the incredible work that the Ivory Coast is doing and bringing all of these countries together, bringing all of us together. And it's another way of building bridges between the United States and Africa, the United States and the Ivory Coast. We're doing a lot of actual building of infrastructure, but this is building connections between people. Sports does that as well as anything. So it's a pleasure to be a part of this tonight, and I want to congratulate again President Ouattara for the extraordinary achievement and the people of the Ivory Coast for the extraordinary achievement.
Blinken is on his second stop of a 4-country tour of West and Central Africa this week. He began Monday morning in Cape Verde before heading to Ivory Coast and will travel on to Nigeria and Angola. A divided U.S. Supreme Court is allowing Border Patrol agents to cut razor wire that Texas installed on the U.S.-Mexican border. Now, this while a lawsuit over the wire continues. Joining us now to talk about this is Kate Lincoln Goldfinch. She's managing partner of Lincoln Goldfinch Law in Austin, Texas. Tell us what this lawsuit, where are we? What is it about?
In this particular lawsuit, the issue is the razor wire, the concertina wire that prohibits Border Patrol from being able to access certain parts of the border and, you know, get to the river, et cetera.
And so the federal government wants access to the border since they are charged with protecting the border, hence the Border Patrol.
Exactly right. So border enforcement is a federal jurisdictional issue in the, you know, one of the federal agencies, the primary one in charge with enforcing border security is the Border Patrol. And so, of course, they want free access and rein to the border area with which they are charged as keeping safe.
So does the state have any right to, I mean, it's the state's border too, right? Is it just a matter of the federal government supersedes the state in this case?
That's right. It's called the Supremacy Clause. It's the Constitution, which says this is when they're, you know, when the federal authority has jurisdiction over something, the state authority comes after that, right? And so this is one of those areas. It's very clearly one of those areas, as was held by the Supreme Court, that federal enforcement of an immigration border between two nations falls within the jurisdiction and the purview of the federal government, not the state government.
So as I understand it, so Texas was keeping the border agents from the border by various means. And in this case, as you pointed out, it's this type of barbed wire. So the agents were going in and the federal agents were going in and cutting it in certain instances. And that's where the lawsuits stem from?
I think that was the initial start of the lawsuit, and it went up to the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals, which sided with Texas, and then up to the Supreme Court, which sided with the Biden administration. And there were things within the lawsuit, like, for example, the Fifth Circuit had said, well, you know, if there is a medical emergency happening, then the federal agents can have access in that situation, and they can cut through the razor wire and access what they need to access. And the Supreme Court, you know, I mean, the Supreme Court didn't say a lot. They just issued an order. But the counter argument to that is that when there is a medical emergency and someone might be drowning in the river, for example, expecting agents to cut through razor wire before they get to a drowning person would, you know, mean that that person dies. And so these are life and death decisions along the border.
Is there another legal step now?
Well, this is an injunction. So the way that an injunction works is it's sort of, while a lawsuit is pending, are there any emergency issues to deal with until we can allow the full case to make its way through the court system? So we do have a lot of lawsuits going right now between the federal government and the state of Texas about our Senate Bill 4 law, about the wire, about the buoys. We're going to hear lots more about it, but this, I say, I would say is a real victory for the federal government and the Biden administration about its authority over border enforcement.
Kate Lincoln Goldfinch, managing partner of Lincoln Goldfinch Law in Austin, Texas. And finally, the world's first routine vaccination program against malaria was launched on Monday in Cameroon. Reuters correspondent Rachel Faber reports it's a mass plan by the United Nations that will ultimately reach other African nations.
The global fight against malaria took a step forward on Monday. Malaria kills nearly 500,000 children under the age of 5 in Africa every year. Cases rose by around 5 million year-on-year in 2022, according to the World Health Organization. The shot being deployed is the WHO-approved RTSS vaccine, developed by British drug maker GSK. Another vaccine developed by Oxford University, R21, could be launched in May or June, according to Gavi. The Global Vaccine Alliance also said that 19 other countries are planning to roll out the routine vaccine program this year. As put simply by Mohamed Abdulaziz of the Africa Centers for Disease Control, "For a long time, we have been waiting for a day like this."
Reuters correspondent Rachel Faber. This has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of everyone here at VOA, thank you so much for joining us. In Washington, I'm Scott Walterman.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The 1830 U.S. law that prohibits the importation of goods made with forced labor was strengthened in 2021 when President Joe Biden signed the Uyghur Forced Labor Prevention Act. The UFLPA bans imports into the United States made by forced labor of products from the Xinjiang Uyghur Autonomous Region. Thea Lee, U.S. Deputy Labor Undersecretary for International Affairs, described that region at a recent congressional hearing.
Xinjiang is China's far western region, of course, where hundreds of thousands of Uyghurs, ethnic Kazakhs, Kyrgyz, and members of other persecuted groups are being arbitrarily detained and subjected to forced labor, producing goods that too often enter the U.S. domestic and global supply chains.
The UNFLPA is implemented through a U.S. government interagency task force that utilizes several tools to counter the importation of goods made with forced labor. Those tools include the development of a list of entities that mine, produce, or manufacture, wholly or in part, any goods or merchandise produced with forced labor in Xinjiang. 20 such entities were identified in the inaugural list. The list has now been expanded by 50%. The task force also identifies high-priority sectors such as textiles, tomatoes, and polysilicon for scrutiny and enforcement. U.S. Customs and Border Protection, the CBP, is responsible for preventing the entry of products made with forced labor into the U.S. market by investigating allegations of forced labor in supply chains. Eric Choi, executive director of the CBP's Trade Remedy Law Enforcement Directorate, told Congress that since the UFLPA took effect in June 2022, the CBP has stopped more than 6,000 shipments of goods valued at more than $2 billion for UFLPA enforcement actions.
The agency is using technology to map supply chains and research high-risk commodities to ensure supply chains are free of forced labor inputs.
Christopher Brzezowski, U.S. Acting Assistant Homeland Security Secretary for Trade and Economic Security Policy, told Congress that since the implementation of the UFLPA, there is significant evidence that industry is taking responsibility for understanding their supply chain seriously, including by shifting and diversifying the supply chain. The United States, as Secretary of State Antony Blinken has said, remains committed to combating forced labor everywhere, including in Xinjiang, where genocide and crimes against humanity are ongoing.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.